Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Coming up on this episode of White Wine Question Time.
And as for health and safety, I mean, I did a lot of the plumbing in the early restaurant. Think of that now. They just did a bit of the gas plumbing as well. I mean, you'd be locked up, throw away the key. I feel like sometimes I maybe let them down that I haven't sort of given them lectures. I mean, my son Jack was fond of saying the only thing I taught him how to cook was how to cut bread, you know. But,
Hush.
And one of us is saying, what do you like best, food or sex? He says, oh, food, definitely. No, sex. No, hang on a minute, food, like this.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is a man who certainly knows his way around a wine list. He's one of our best-loved and best-known chefs who's been running restaurants for over 40 years and making cookery shows for almost 30. In fact, he opened his first restaurant 48 years ago and, well, never really looked back. Such is his pull. 30,000 people booked reservations and joined the waiting list at his 10 restaurants as soon as we came out of lockdown, which is ironic when you consider that he actually never wanted to run a restaurant. At the time, in the mid-70s, he had a mobile disco, yeah, and he wanted to run a nightclub. And for a while he did, but it only attracted drunken, brawling fishermen in the Cornish village of Padstow, and their bloody bust-ups got the place shut down and his licence revoked. You can run a restaurant, he was told, but not a nightclub. And so he did. In fact, such has been his impact on Padstow, it's now commonly referred to as Padstein. But he was actually born and raised in the Cotswolds and only moved to the coast as an 18-year-old. The family relocated when his father was forced to take early retirement and was struggling with depression. Tragically, within months of arriving there, his dad took his own life. Running from his grief, he travelled the world for 2 years, and upon his return, read English at Oxford University as a mature student. Returning to Padstow with a degree in hand, he started dating his first wife and business partner, Jill, with whom he has three grown-up sons and a wildly successful food empire, made all the more buoyant by his increasing fame, having made 30 food shows for the BBC and written more than 25 best-selling cookbooks. Now 76, he's married to his second wife, Sarah, and lives between their home in her native Australia, London, and Padstow, where his three sons help run the family business alongside him and their mother. But today he's in none of those places. In fact, he's on his travels mid-book tour. So let's dial him in, shall we? It's Rick Stein. Good morning, Rick Stein. Where on earth on this planet do I find you today?
Good morning, Kate. Well, I'm actually in Newcastle. I had to think for a second to decide where I was. We did a book conversation last night with a local book shop, which we'd had 300 people there. And I'm just talking about Simple Suppers, and it went really well, actually. Everybody had a copy of the book, which is very nice. And today we're off to Morpeth, and then Edinburgh after that. Yeah.
Do you feel like the Mick Jagger of cookery? You know, like all these people turning up for you. You're a man that should have your feet up, but you're still rocking and rolling wherever the crowds come.
Well, not at all. But I mean, I must say, I'm approaching Mick Jagger's wonderful age. I've got a few years to go. But I still like working, really. I still like writing cookbooks and going on the road. I've travelled when I've done these book tours with the same Claire Scott, the same people and the same driver, Barry, every for about 20 years.
So it's
a bit like, you know, a bit like a rock and roll band. We're back on the road again. It's Friday. It must be Newcastle.
Well, here's some rock and roll stats around you. People talk about getting a reservation at one of your... Is it still 10 restaurants that you've got?
Yes.
Yeah. At one of your 10 restaurants is like... They're like Glastonbury tickets. They're that hard to get.
They're not.
Well, when we came out of lockdown, Rick, 30,000 people registered for bookings as the roadmap for coming out of lockdown was laid out to us. In your restaurants, 30,000 people wanted to come and eat in one of your 10 restaurants. That's rock and roll.
Okay, fair enough. That sounds very impressive, I have to say. But, I mean, just obviously, it depends what time one... I mean, if I'm talking about the Padstow restaurants or the Sandbanks one, the summer is really busy, I admit. But I bet if you rang the seafood up now in Padstow, that you could get in tonight, you know, no probs. Funny, interesting thing about restaurants, though, if you can stand the stress, you tend to find if you ring up at the last minute, you can probably get in because there's always cancellations. And but it's not, if you want to go with friends and you want to have a special event, it's probably not worth the stress.
Now, that is a bit stressy. Yeah, that's a bit sweaty of upper lip. Another rock and roll stat for you was the fact that the Sydney Morning Herald... because let's face it, Rick, like Mick Jagger, you're global. You're known on both sides of the planet. Described you as something of a sex symbol. Writing that apparently when you do your swimming shots in your cookery shows, there's many a man and woman waiting with bated breath for you to emerge sort of like, you know, Ursula Andress style from the lapping waves. How about that then?
Well, I haven't seen that one. Maybe just as well. It's a bit embarrassing.
I'd get it laminated if I was you.
It's just the Matt, the director, said, go on, we'll have a swim. Because really the reason I do all this swimming is he's got this sort of GoPro thing, you know, a little... And he loves interviewing me in the water, right? Likes to swim himself. So it's like... we're always stripping off and jumping in so we can take underwater pics of us swimming.
It's nuts, isn't it, Rick? When you think about when you started out in telly, I was about 2 years behind you, right? So I feel that we've emerged through all this technology together.
Yeah.
Back in the day, to get an aerial shot, you'd have to charter a helicopter. That was a big line in the budget. Now you just throw a drone in the air or stick a GoPro on. I mean, the world has advanced massively.
That's such a good point, Kate, because I can remember the problems of getting an air helicopter.
Yeah.
I remember once... I can't remember the company, thank goodness I can't, but they were sort of cheaper than the rest.
Ooh, never good with a helicopter.
The helicopter, where were we? Oh, on a tour in Devon, on the, you know, Dartmoor. And the two guys got out of the helicopter and just lay on the ground because they got such minging hangovers, right? And I just had a look at the controls and they're all tied up with tape and rubber bands and things. Anyway, we did it, survived. But those were the days, you know, now a drone.
Piece of cake, isn't it?
Yeah.
But, you know, I used to love the theatre of all of that. Like, you know, you'd have to get up at 5 a.m. to get the sunrise shot with, you know, a helicopter, and then you'd meet the helicopter pilot, because I used to do travel shows for the BBC.
Yeah.
And then, and like, you never knew if they were joking or not when they'd go, I've never done this before. And like, flown a helicopter.
It's such a good point, though, because, I mean, drones are like, you know, they're just tiny, you know, and they do the same thing. And my director I worked with for 25 years, David Pritchard, he used to call them effing drones, right? Because he was old school and he just hated them because we had to, you know, he got all he needed and then we had to launch the drone, you know. And of course, the drone pilots in the old days were, I mean, they're now our second cameraman, Martin, does all the drone shots. We used to hire them in. And they could be quite bolshy and sort of like into their art, so they weren't very directable. But now it's okay.
No, I mean, literally now you can order them online. They're here the next day. You literally throw them in the air and direct them. I mean, it's a stunning piece of kit, but it is doing a lot of cameramen and women out of a job.
Yeah, I think so. Technology,
such as the world of AI. The thing is, you know, you can get all the tech you like in the world. No one's going to be able to shell a prawn or, you know, fry a scallop like you, Rick. So I think you're almost AI proof.
Well, I think so. I think the whole, you know, cooking restaurants are AI proof, certainly in the actual production of the meal. You could find little robot rushing around getting Dover soles out of the fridge and heating up the. But it's quite a long shot, that one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, there's some things that do require a human touch.
Yeah.
And maybe, I mean, this is all the stuff that you're going to be getting into, because I know you've got live shows coming up next year. Tickets have gone on sale today, I believe, the day that we're recording.
Yes.
Congratulations. An evening with Rick Stein. And I mean, I logged on last night to see if I could buy a ticket, and I have to join a waiting list. There's a waiting list to buy your tickets.
Gosh.
Look at you, Mick Jagger, in a penny.
I suppose this book tour is a bit of a dry run, because what I'm doing actually, because it's evolved actually, book tours. In the old days, all you did was go into a bookshop and sign books. But now you've got a big audience. I had 500 in Bath the other day. And so, you know, you've got to be quite entertaining to sell your book these days. You can't just sign them. But it does give me a chance to try a few routines out, Kate, you know?
It's a dry run, because, you know, when you think back to how you began selling your wares, tell me if I've got this wrong, but in the early days when you opened the restaurant, you would put flyers on windscreens in cars that were parked locally, or drive through a caravan park with a megaphone telling people to book in.
It's true. Gosh, I don't know where, that's funny. That's the first time anybody's reminded me of that. But we did. I mean, it seems the most antisocial thing to do now is to go around loads of cars in a car park, put a brightly coloured sticker under their windscreen, and also the megaphone thing. But hey ho, it worked, you know. And but in that, this is like in the 70s, so it was sort of like things are a bit sort of looser in those days, as was the cooking, I have to say.
Was it really?
Well, I mean, the thing is that what's happened over the years is that people have become much more knowledgeable about food and cooking, and therefore much more demanding about how their food is cooked. But in the early days, everybody was, you know, restaurants, there were a few very well-known restaurants, but opening a restaurant was fairly easy to do. I mean, there were no health and safety regulations, and you didn't really need that much in terms of decor. I mean, our first decor in the seafood restaurant was just a load of old herring nets and tables with, you know, red check tables and candles in bottles. And as for health and safety, I mean, I did a lot of the plumbing in the early restaurant. Think of that now. Think of that. did a bit of the gas plumbing as well. I mean, you'd be locked
bloody
up,
throwing
away the key these days.
Different times.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that takes me very nicely to my very first question for you, if that's all right. I shall dive in and serve my first course. Your dreams of becoming a coastal nightclub owner were dashed horribly after the police shut you down, leaving you with no option but to open a restaurant. So you kind of, your hand was forced into this fabulous life that you've gone on to establish. And 40 years, well, it's now 45 years on almost, isn't it, that the seafood restaurant opened? That remains kind of, you know, the heartbeat of your business. But I wondered, when else in life has bad news turned out to be the ultimate blessing in disguise? Because I know when you were shut down, you were devastated. You really thought that you were going to be the Peter Stringfellow of Padstow, and it wasn't to be, was it?
No, I mean, it was not exactly the Peter Stringfellow.
I just realised you ran a strip club. Sorry, Rick.
We didn't have poles in the club, although we did, but there was sort of nets hanging from that too. It's sort of like, it is extraordinary what you're saying, that sometimes terrible things, and I was really devastated. I was declared not fit and proper person to hold a drinks licence.
Through no fault of yours, actually, but I mean, like, you know, when you assess the scenes that the police were being called out to, you don't in this nightclub thinking, oh my God, this place is going to be rammed and jumping, it's the era of disco, it's going to be great. And actually, it was just drunken fishermen having massive bust-ups.
Correct.
On the pavement outside, that you literally couldn't even scrub the blood from the tarmac, could you, before
stage,
there was a fresh layer.
I have to say, I remember after that notorious trouble fight, somebody got struck with a broken glass. I said to my friend Johnny, in business partner, I said, we just can't go on like this, right? And I mean, we were just so young and so not equipped to run a nightclub with a late license. That in fact what happened was, looking back, was the best thing that could have happened to us, being closed down. And I probably said in my memoir, but it was so, I think I did, but about 4 or 5 years after we were closed down, the policeman had closed us down, the inspector, invited me over for tea, right? And just said, we felt really sorry for you boys because you were just so, so green behind the ears, but there's nothing we can do for you, but, you know, make sure you were closed down. And by then, I was starting to make a bit of a name for myself for, you know, the cooking. And I just said, well, to be honest, he was called Ian Hooper. It was the best thing that happened to us, you know. And I suppose there's a few things in life when things go wrong. I mean, I remember once I was I got a job on a freighter in New Zealand, going through all these exotic places, like through the Far East, what we call the Far East then, like Southeast Asia, you know, calling off in Bangkok, Singapore, can't remember where else. And
this would have been what?
It was about 1967, I think, 66, 67.
Wow. And so I got this
job.
World.
I got a job in an engine room on this boat. And the skipper said, I'm sorry, we're not going there. We're going via America. So I said, fine. Off we went to America. And as a result of that, I traveled by Greyhound bus all around America. And then I went to Mexico. And actually, going to Mexico for me is like an amazingly important part in my sort of culinary development, because for the first time I'd had this sort of incredibly, for a much used word, vibrant food, very colourful, very hot, and flavours of sort of coriander, which I wasn't familiar with, and lots of chilli. And I did a whole series out of it. You know, I did a programme retracing my steps. So in the words of The Sound of Music, behind every cloud there's a silver lining, or whatever it was.
There is if you look for it. There is if you look for it. Every pig's ear has the potential to be a silk purse.
Correct, Kate. The philosopher in you is blossoming.
This morning, I don't know where I'm pulling it from, Rick. I'm exhausted by lunchtime. I'll need to lie down at this rate.
But actually, sometimes, the bit in The Sound of Music, when the good Lord closes a door, somewhere he opens a window. There you go.
That's right. So tell me about some of those other windows that have popped open. Because so much of your life was never planned, right?
No, it's sort of...
There was no roadmap. You were literally just...
It's funny because when I don't know who first coined the phrase, but when David, the director I worked with and loved to bits, when we were doing Secret France, he said, "I know, let's make this a journey without maps." And I guess that you could say that about my life, really. You know, things just turn up, and I think in a lot of cases, it's like stuff happens, but you've got a sort of, it depends how you deal with it, you know. And you can either get, "Oh, woe is me," or you can say, "Well, I'm going to pick myself up here. I'm glad it's happened, you know, move on."
Yeah. And actually, a lot of your, like you say, you know, while you were working in that engine room, you ended up in Mexico, which was so informative to you. Those years when you ran away to sea, as you call it, that was following the death of your father.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm guessing that, you know, you're a young 18-year-old guy, doesn't know how to process his feelings.
Yeah.
Just is on the run, running from your grief.
Yeah.
It's true.
I mean, you know, you don't think that at the time. You just think, you know, I remember the Animal song, "We've got to get out of this place," you know, at that time. And I was thinking, I've got to get away. But I didn't sort of realise what was driving me at the time. But it was like grief and sort of like, you know, the sort of, it's quite a gloomy thing having a father that's committed suicide. It's hard to come to terms with. It's embarrassing, you know, and it also you're missing your dad. So it was a time, a really good time to run away, I must say. And so I guess it's, I mean, I'm loving the way you're putting my life, which seems to be a sort of a series of dealing with sort of like things going wrong. But there is a sort of pattern there, I guess.
I think that's everybody's life, though, isn't it?
Yes, I think so.
To varying degrees. I mean, what happened to you as a 17-year-old was extreme in the worst, you know, it beyond most people's imaginations, you know, you losing your dad in the circumstances that you did. But then running away to figure out how to deal with it, there was an intelligence to that in some ways, because it was so raw being at home that actually stepping back probably gave you a chance to reflect in a place that was otherworldly.
I think so. It's quite interesting because I was talking to a journalist because I've written about all this in my autobiography, and I've always thought myself as being like cautious and not pushing myself. And he just said, "No, you aren't. You really aren't." I guess it's the way one, you know, the way one thinks of oneself is not necessarily the whole picture, I think.
And it's funny because you're this dichotomy of like low self-esteem but full of so much self-belief. For example, flunked your exams as, you know, as a grief-stricken teenager, go off around the world, really get a taste for the world, like you say, travel. I mean, you did Australia, New Zealand, Mexico, America, you were everywhere, but then came back and applied to Oxford as a mature student. So someone with lower self-esteem, that seems odd.
Well, I know. I'd picked up some information about Oxford that they were really keen to get sort of mature, slightly more mature people. I mean, it was only about 22, 23 at the time, but because they just wanted a bit of a balance. And I guess just after the Second World War, we had lots of people returning from the Second World War. And so there was this really good mix of people in universities. But then latterly, it just became 18-year-olds leaving school. And, I mean, I was older and I'd been to places. I think they just wanted me as part of the mix, which indeed I was, you know, because I had been to places. I was still very young, actually. And it didn't totally work out because I just really liked the partying in Oxford and the social life. And I got a third-class degree, which, you know, there's one or two people like Evelyn Moore who also got a third class degree. So I'm sort of like in very good company, but I felt a bit bad about that.
The thing is, at the time, we put so much importance on those grades right now. People just, you know, for example, I read about you. I just read that you went to Oxford as a mature student and read English. I don't care what grade you got.
No, it's a good
just
point.
The fact that you even got in there, you know, is flipping brilliant, especially on the back of such a difficult personal time in your life, you know? Commendable.
Yeah. I mean, I'd urge anybody that if they've got a bit of spare time, if they think they could get to university, go, because it's just, I don't know whether it's special to go to places like Oxford, Cambridge, Durham, or St. Andrews with this sort of ancientness about them, which has a great aura about it. But my two of my sons went to Cardiff, and I think they felt the same thing, that it's just being that particular age and just growing up with it, really, and having, you know, having a good social life and having plenty of friends. I mean, I guess the friends that I made at university are the ones that are still friendly with, you know, still know, the ones that are still alive, that is. That's another thing.
I know. You know, as you travel through life, you go, oh, I've got a wedding this weekend. Oh, now it's funerals. Suddenly you just jump from that to that. And you're like, how did that bloody happen? Different outfit entirely, isn't it?
It is true, actually. One of my friends just died, and she sent this text saying, I've had enough. 6 funerals since March. It can't go on like this.
My mum and her sister, they treat it as a sort of kind of an extension of their social life now. So they keep an eye on the obits, because I'm from Cheltenham in Gloucestershire, not too far from where you were born and raised, actually, Rick.
Absolutely.
And they do a lot of, we're representing the family, but I do think there is a great social element to it as well, and a buffet.
Well, I always remember, because funny, my mother in her latter years lived in Burford, which is quite near Cheltenham. And as her friends fell off the perch, me and my sister Henrietta used to say to her, how come you're not more upset? And she just said, well, just people are dying so fast. You know, I think when people die when you're young, I can remember, I'm sure you can, Kate, sort of various friends that died at an early age.
Shocking.
It's shocking. It's like 4 weddings and a funeral, you know. But the older you get, the less sort of surprised you are, to be honest.
Yeah, quite right. Let me take you to your next question, if that's okay.
Yes.
I'd like to rewind the clock, Rick. And I wondered if you could... I know you're a man that loves a pint at 5:30.
Yes. Right?
That's your optimum pint time, isn't it?
Well, it's just because when we were filming, David, the director, we always had to try and make 5:29, right? And for a pint, finish filming and go 5:29. The reason I now realise, he was a film editor here in Newcastle for years and years. And the earliest evening news started at, I think, 5:30. So he had to get all the films cut and ready to go by sort of 5:28. So straight into the pub at 5:29.
And therein lies your tradition. Brilliant. Yeah. Okay, so I want you to... it's 5:29. There's an evening ahead of you, and you get to share a pint with your 18-year-old self, that young man that ran away around the world to heal his heart. What would you, as a 76-year-old now, sit down and share with him? What wisdom have you acquired that might have saved him a little bit of heartache?
I just think probably it's just a very, very obvious thing, but time heals. And, there's nothing more that you can say. There's all kinds of, stuff you can bring in from your life experience. But I think it's sort of, time is ticking away nicely.
Too quickly.
Yeah, but also when things go wrong, you know, the body and the mind and the sort of change of circumstances just tends in the end to sort it all out. And it's not saying very much. It's just, you know.
But your introduction to adult life was pretty brutal. You know, most people at that age don't contend with what you did. Do you look back and do you feel a sense of pride at how you pulled yourself through that? You, your siblings, your mum, dark times.
It's sort of, I suppose, but so many other people go through things like that. Mm. It's only my personal experience, but basically life is tough, you know. It's all very, we all want to be happy all the time and sort of nice things happening to us, but generally it's the reverse. It's just how you deal with it, I think. That's the other thing I'd say to my 18-year-old. It's like, not only don't panic, but the other thing I'd probably say in modern day is don't blame other people for everything, you know? You've got to look after yourself, and you've got to say, look, you know, don't be, if there is definitely a chance. I mean, definitely not a chance. But if there is an occasion where somebody else is to blame, fine. But it just seems to me, but that's, I would say this at my age, that it's this whole idea of sort of entitlement that young people seem to feel that somebody else is to blame. And I think it's sort of almost something to do with the whole, not just young people, but everybody is always looking for somebody else for the responsibility, when a lot of the time the responsibility rests with you, like it or not, you know? And I'm not saying out of that you should just sort of grin and bear it, but I think there's a balance, you know? And I think as long as you sort of realise that a lot of the time things aren't going to go well, and you just need to deal with it, you know?
And expect it.
And don't expect everything. Unfortunately.
Yeah, well, that's where that sense of entitlement can come from, because you expect everything to go right. It's like, no one's gifted that, trust me. And actually, it's the bumps in the road that teach us the most.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, you know, we've just talked about all the way through, like losing my licence as a 18-year-old. No, I was a bit older than that, but it just, I learned so much out of it, really, you know.
Yeah.
It's funny the way life lessons is. Yeah, life lessons.
Well, life lessons, yeah. And then, of course, you've got the extraordinary situation now where you now have three grown sons. They all work for you, with yourself and your ex-wife and still business partner. Have you imparted a lot of these life lessons, this acquired wisdom, to them, or is that something you've had to sort of sit back and watch them do for themselves?
I think you just, I don't, I feel like sometimes I maybe let them down that I haven't sort of given them lectures. I mean, my son Jack was fond of saying the only thing I taught him how to cook was how to cut bread, you know. But,
Hush.
I don't know, I guess it's maybe because I'm a bit selfish, a bit self-centred, or maybe it's more than that, just, you know, I just get on with it. I'm not sure. I'm still trying to work that one out. I feel I should have done more for them, but, you know, they're grown up and they're... it's funny because I did an article I did an interview in the Daily Mail the other day, and my sons were described as my middle-aged sons. Not sure they're quite ready for that yet, to be honest.
But they seem to really know the roles that they play within the family business. So you go onto your website and there's an opportunity to meet all kind of six of you, actually, because you've got one of your daughter-in-laws involved in the business now as well. But they have all very defined roles. One's in charge of architecture and the maintenance side of it. Then there's one son who's in charge of all the booze, the other one who's the director of all the chefs that work across the business. I mean, it's almost like you made a plasticine Play-Doh family with their job titles in mind. How did it come to be, Rick?
I think it's just pure chance, really. I don't think there was there wasn't any decision for, you know, Ed to be involved in the design and Jack in the food and Charlie in the booze. It's just the way they've sort of, what they've done in their lives. And it does work really well, because in a family business, the one thing you don't want is competition, you know, and they do understand that, you know, they don't want to fall out with each other. They all get on very well with each other. And I think they realize that one of the ways of not falling out is being responsible for different areas in the business.
It's like a foodie succession, isn't it?
Don't know.
You're Logan Roy.
I met Logan Roy the other night, went to the theatre, and he was on in Brian Cox in Bath.
You know, did you?
Yeah. You sort of forget this, you know, you think it's like years and years ago when there was the first Poldark series, and one of my Padstow fishermen guys, not particularly sort of sophisticated, came up to, I can't remember what he was called, the actor that played Poldark, and said, "Good morning, Ross."
Oh, Aidan Turner.
No, it was before that one. Yeah, I can't remember, but said, "Good morning, Ross." it's almost sometimes you forget you're talking to an actor, not the real person.
Yeah. Was he excited to meet you?
No, he didn't know who I was, but then he sort of discovered who I was. It was quite nice, actually, because Trevor Nunn, who was directing the play. And, I know him well because he had a house in Cornwall near Padstow. So, and I hadn't seen him for ages. So, you know, sort of like Trevor Nunn said, "What an honour, Rick." And I said, "No, I don't think it's an honour." But I think Logan was quite impressed with that. But he was really nice. I mean, I did like him. And his wife, yeah, fantastic. They're both in the play. It was about Bach. It was fab.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
How much do you attribute your natural curiosity to your travels? Because I think the more you see of the world, the more questions it presents, the more answers you go in search for.
You know, Kate, I just always think I was just really lucky because I started off cooking, and the reason I got into TV and all that was really just to promote the restaurants.
Yeah.
And then I got into traveling, and what I realized that actually traveling and finding food is the best way to communicate with people all over the world. And I mean, you know, times are so awful at the moment, but I do think that if you go to somebody's country and you want to talk to them about their food, it's just the most sort of, it's not talking about the weather, it's talking about something they really, really want to talk about. And it doesn't matter where you go, it's very, if you talk to local people about what they like to eat, it's very disarming for them, and you become very, you know, it's very easy to make friends. And I think it's one of my, I had this really good journalist friend called Johnny Apple, who was a American journalist, who was actually a chief political correspondent for the New York Times for a long time, but his sideline was food. And he once said to me, "You can't go wrong with food. You can go to somewhere, talk about food, and that's the main thing. But then bring in a few other things at the same time," which is what I do, really. I just like, because I love architecture, I love art, I love music. So I bring everything, literature as well, poetry. I sort of like bring everything into it. And it's not that I'm sort of putting it on, because I really like all that stuff, but it works, you know? It's like what I always say is about... you know, my dog Chalky, right?
Yeah.
That made it into the first of my TV programs. Well, the great thing about David Pritchard was that he just saw that if you're going to make an interesting program, it has to have little bits to it. You can't just go and say, right, I'm going to cook in the next half an hour, I'm going to cook five dishes. You know, it's fast forward then, because you just think, well, I'm just, I would be bored. what you do is you cook three dishes and then you get the dog in every now and then, right?
Because people love the dog, right, for a start. Yeah. But also what you started to do is go, okay, I'm going to cook this. And by the way, meet Dave. Dave caught this fish earlier. Dave lives here. This is the story of this village, this town, these people. You set a story to a dish. So by the time it came to taste it, you'd already invested in it.
Yeah, that's right.
Journalism.
Oh, is it?
Well, yeah, it is, because you want it to be a journalist. So you set the story. And actually, you know, the eating of the food, by the time you raise the fork for the first mouthful, you are invested in what's on that plate.
Yeah,
you've told the story of the dish.
It's true. And it's the same thing, really, that if you want to get people's attention, you have to... It has to be more than just write what's in front of them, you know. It's like in a novel, it's not just about the plot, it's about everything else in there, you know. You know, so there you go.
Great journalism. The stories that you put across your cookbooks help you to want to invest in which dish to cook. It's the stories that you set to them. What are your favourite simple suppers?
It's hard because it's the book's full of recipes that I really like, of course. I wouldn't be there if they weren't. And so I would always go to one or two sort of slightly quirky dishes in the book. There's one in there which comes from Portugal, which is just for a dish of clams, but you can use cockles or you can use mussels. And it's just with a bit of butter, a bit of olive oil, some chili, a bit of garlic, white wine, and coriander, right? And the reason it works and why I like it so much is that nobody apart from the Portuguese in Europe really cooks with coriander. So to have what you think is going to be like a French type of, you know, mussel bivalve dish flavored with coriander, it's that sort of shock of, hey, this is great, you know? And it seemed to me to epitomize the sort of essence of the book, which is about simplicity, but also about like saying, hey, I really like this. I mean, another dish in the book is from the old, I don't know if you remember, I'm sure you do, the spaghetti houses in London in the
70s. Yes.
Well, there's a dish that I got from there, which was just a pasta, spaghetti, with olive oil and garlic and parsley, right? And you see how...
Which sounds lazy, so tell me it's not.
It's not. I mean, it's just, I think that's the first time, and I think I say in the book that it's the first time I realised, having been brought up with, I don't know, like if you can think of sort of tin spaghetti, right, with just a bit of pasta and loads of tomato sauce, this idea of just putting just a bit of oil, bit of garlic, bit of parsley, you know, maybe if you like a bit of chilli, but I don't think there was in the original, and it's all about the pasta, it just sort of, I think a lot of the time, you know, you draw attention to what is the essentials of a dish just by keeping it really, really simple. Another dish in there, one more, because I don't want to bore you, but there's one dish.
No, listen, I'm loving it, because I also wanted to talk to you about your croque monsieur as well, because posh cheese on toast, I'm there for.
Would you call it the lazy croque monsieur? Because I've taken out the bechamel sauce. It's still really nice.
It's bougie cheese on toast, Rick. But the fact that you've given me permission to call that a meal, therefore.
I think, sometimes in some of the recipes in the book, I was thinking, is this really a recipe? You know, but then I was thinking, well, yeah, it is, you know. Mm. I mean, you know, I don't know whether it was Delia Smith or somebody, how to boil an egg. You know, you say, well, is there any different way of boiling an egg? Well, I think there might be. You know, if you put salt in the water, it tends to firm up the white a bit more.
Does it? I didn't know that.
I don't know, actually. I did a piece the other day boiling an egg. And I said, you know, this is boiling an egg for shelling them. But I said it, and it's gone out in the next programme. I'm doing a new series at the moment called Rick Stein's Food Stories, about travelling around Great Britain looking for food stories. And I'm saying this and I'm thinking, I hope this is right, but I haven't tested it.
What's been the most unlikely story that you've uncovered in your search for these tales across our shores?
Well, there was one that was particularly sort of, I mean, most of them are, a lot of the time we're sort of highlighting the incredible debt we have in this country to food from other countries. So we've got lots of Indian food, Korean food, you name it, it's in there. A lot of Italian, of course. But there was one, I mean, again, it's like you've got a bit of warp and weft in a series. And there's one place in Bristol where we filmed in a community centre with this, I'm not sure what nationality it was. Yeah, from the Cape Verde Islands. But she had three women cooking with her, one who didn't want to be named because they're all modern slaves, right? And we didn't go into any of their backgrounds as to how they, you know, got to this country and what they were expected to do. But each one was an Ethiopian and Egyptian. I can't remember the other one. It'll come to me. They cooked the sort of food from their countries. And it was just if you want sort of testimony to the power of food to do good, the way these women were talking about how grateful they were to this lady from the Cape Verde Islands about bringing them all together and allowing them to cook in this very nice community centre. It was just really moving, you know, and it's sort of, I mean, lots of the other things, I mean, there's a piece about, you know, roast beef and Yorkshire pudding and, you know, you name it, it's there. But that one really, I haven't seen it yet. I haven't watched the rough cut, but I think it'd be quite powerful.
But the story is what has drawn you. It's already made you care about that dish without even tasting it, right?
You're
invested in it. Because there's a romance to that. It's about good overcoming bad. We just had, in recent episode, Her Royal Highness Princess Eugenie on the show, who has a podcast herself, which deals with trying to abolish, and shines a lot on her work, to abolish modern-day slavery. 50 million people are enslaved across the world right now, more people than at any other time in living memory. Isn't that extraordinary, Rick?
Yeah, it is, isn't it? I mean, I'm afraid it's just, you know, I suppose we went through a period of thinking life was getting better generally, but it ain't, you know. Not for a lot of people.
It's just carved up differently. So, yeah, for a lot of these people, and a lot of people that are living as modern slaves are not even aware that they qualify for that status because of the way that they've been brought into a country or into a situation, or they're not paid correctly, or, you know, so on and so forth. But the fact that food can bring those people from those communities together and give them a shared moment, there's power in that, isn't there?
There is. I feel very grateful because food, cooking and food is such a great entry into so much else in life. Of course it is, because we all have to eat to live, you know.
And it's life-giving, right?
It's life-giving, absolutely.
With Simple Supples still very much on the tip of our tongue, can I move to my third and final question with you?
Yes, certainly.
I wanted to devise a chef's table. The idea of a chef's table is incredibly evocative, I think. It's an opportunity for you to sit and watch a master at work as you gather with your nearest and dearest. So I wondered if you had to elect a chef to compile the ultimate simple supper, who would it be? But equally, who would populate your chef's table? Dead or alive, chefs, non-chefs, whoever it is, just people that have brought something to your table in life.
That's a really hard one, of course, but I'm going to work on it. Now, who would I get to cook? It'd be one of my friends, I think.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, who are you thinking? Like, you know, Escoffier or somebody like that?
It's whenever I put that question to you, it's whoever springs to mind. You know, it's about simple food with sensational people that have really brought something to your table.
They'd be the sort of people that, you know, do understand why good food is good, why simple dishes are what they are, and who just sort of spend their life just doing the same thing again. There's another chef friend of mine called Sean Hill, and I asked him not so long ago why he's still doing it. He's the same age as me, and he's still actually cooking in the Walnut Tree in Abergavenny. And he said, do you know what? He said, I get into work in the morning and there is a box of perfectly fresh red mullet. And he said, and then I start thinking on what I'm going to do with it for the customers, you know. And it's sort of that endless recurring enthusiasm in some of my friends that I share that I really think is why it's so special being a cook. As to who I'd cook for, Don't know. Probably Elizabeth David is probably, of all cookery book writers, is probably the one that has inspired me most over my life.
Which is, I've read you kind of citing her before. Not many people do. She obviously really resonated with you.
Well, yes. I mean, it's just because it's a sort of, there are certain writers, cookery book writers, who are also great writers. And I think it's exactly what you were saying earlier. It's not just so much about the dish, it's what's behind the dish, the sort of what you bring to that dish. And hers was the sort of joy of arriving in the Mediterranean after the Second World War and just seeing how deprived the UK was at that time due to rationing and deprivations of war, and just finding this sort of unbelievable sort of texture and colour and flavour, and turning it really successfully into words, I think. So there'd be her. How many is this going to be? We could go on forever.
Well, you can have a table of six. That's normally a chef's table, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, interestingly, one of the other ones would be Brillat Savarin, the sort of 18th century French writer who wrote The Philosophy of Taste. And basically it's about the sort of thing that interests me, about what is so special about food. What does it mean? How does it sort of work for people? And he looks at it almost as a sort of scientific process, right? But he includes, obviously, flavour and the look of dinner tables and a bit of sex as well, actually, because he's clearly very keen on the ladies, which is not like sort of, it's not pornographic in any way, but he brings in the fact that eating and sex are quite sort of similar in some ways, which is nice. But also he says that the best number for a dinner party is 8.
He says, and based on what?
Just on the more is too many, and people don't sort of get into an 8. There's enough communication happening and enough people to make all the ideas and the thoughts memorable. So I'd have him, but I don't know whether he'd like the simple modern food.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it depends how. That's interesting, isn't it? That he drew those parallels all those years ago between food and sex, because both are life giving and pleasure giving and life sustaining, right?
It's sort of interesting, isn't it? Because I mean, there's a bit. I don't know. I think it's in Simple Suppers, or maybe the book before, when I'm talking to David, and one of us is saying, "What do you like best, food or sex?" And the other, I think it might have been David. He says, oh, food, definitely. No, sex. Now, hang on a minute, food, like this.
I think you had this conversation with Simon Rimmer, because he recounted it on this podcast.
Did he?
Where he said there was something about the comparison with food and sex. And a good meal should make you want to go upstairs and have sex straight away, is what he was saying. He said that you told him that?
Yeah, that was, again, David Pritchard. But we were sort of having a bit of a whinge about food guides, all right, you know, when they're sort of very critical of what you've done. And David just said, well, just think of it like this, Ricky, he said, you know, you could have a nice meal and say, or you could have a meal and say, now, what was wrong with that? I don't think the wine was the right temperature to blah, 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 right? Or you could say, that was sensational, let's go upstairs, you know? So that sort of... It sort of divides the world into those people that take...
Sounds like we need David at your table.
Yes, definitely. He's got to be there. David Pritchard.
Yeah. He's been a bit real guiding hand in your life, actually, hasn't he? Who would you sit next to, David, to get the best out of him?
I'd certainly sit a lady. So I've got to think of a lady now. Because, David was just very charming. He was a bit like Alfred Hitchcock. We often called him Alfred Hitchcock because he was a bit fat. But he had a really, really good vocabulary, and he was charming in verbally, you know. And so I don't know. I just think I don't know whether Elizabeth David would be the right person next to him, because she was great. But she once said to my first publisher said of Elizabeth, said she could be quite disagreeable at times. She threw a cookery book at me. So I'd have to think of somebody.
What about Keith Floyd? Because Keith Floyd was a big educator in terms of giving you permission to be you on screen, right? You famously stood in for him. Yeah. And that led to you having your own extraordinary television career. Had you been covering for anyone else, do you think you would have felt as licensed to be you?
I don't know. I mean, I think the whole sort of like type of cookery program was developed between David Pritchard and Keith Floyd. And it's funny because my wife, Sass, has only just started watching old Keith Floyd programs. And she just says how really good he was as a presenter. You know, I mean, I don't know if presenter is the right word, because he was just so larger than life. You know, I don't know whether somebody is... I mean, I suppose Jeremy Clarkson's the same sort of presenter, you know.
But not as universally loved. I think Floyd was loved. Like, you'd laugh at him. He was always, you know, even the parodies sending him out where he was always half cut, cooking something. There was an affection for him that I don't think Jeremy Clarkson garners, certainly from females.
That's so interesting, because I think Keith was sort of, in a way... It's hard to put in words what I'm thinking, really, but he wasn't particularly sort of self-aware in a funny sort of way, whereas I think probably Jeremy Clarkson is. And he horrible expression, but he was what he was, you know? And he'd just sort of like get on there and slurp a lot of wine and, you know, he could be quite sort of like verbal at times. You know, the way he was always like telling the cameraman to move, come and watch me. He was sort of, in a funny sort of way, there was a sort of innocence about him, but maybe it's just where he fitted in the sort of whole sort of development of cookery programs on telly. I think who I'd like next to David would be Delia Smith, right? Because,
This is shaping up to be quite the table, by the way. This is like the history of food with a knife and fork in its hand.
Well, I mean, because... I know Delia quite well, and I'm really fond of her, right? I met her the other night. She was at a party, and she just wanted to talk about Norwich Football Club, to be honest. But, I mean, she did such a lot for all of us in the 70s. But David once did this sort of skitty programme for local TV called Cooking It Up, and he had Delia Smith... as a schoolgirl coming home and burning the cakes, right? And somebody like you, Kate, I guess, do you think Delia would like this? And they said, not at all. Not approve. So I'd really like to put them together, because I think ultimately they'd have got on really well.
That's nice. This table is shaping up nicely. I think you've got room for one more.
Oh, God.
And obviously, because you're there, so who else is going to make that final chair?
Well, I suppose there's this artist friend of mine called David Renfrey, who's like he did the Royal Academy's summer exhibition this year, and he paints dogs, but much more importantly, he paints women. He loves women, but they're like, he just seems to me, in as much as a male, I could ever truly understand women. But his paintings just show women, and all types of women, really interestingly. And I mean, the other thing he loves is dancing. So that his perfect life is painting women when they're dancing and painting their faces. And I just love his work, because the women are so sort of like passionate but intelligent and thoughtful and going through something always, you know. So probably David Renfrew, because he likes a glass of red wine. And listen, I've just got to add to my dinner party, because last time I did one of these I couldn't bring my wife in, but I'd definitely bring Sass because I don't think I've ever, until I met Sass, I'd never really enjoyed whatever you call dinner parties these days, because in the Simple Suppers there's a sort of bit of a joke. I do these essays in the book, which is like, I know, a couple of pages about the death of the dinner party. But I end up by saying, doesn't matter what you call it, we all love getting together. But the person that's really good at that is Sass, because she's sort of, she loves sort of decorating the tables of our things, but she just loves getting the right people together, you know? And I just think that's, when going back to Brillat Savarin, that's the other point he's making big time about, about having a dinner party is understanding the connection between each of the people at dinner, and that's what she does. And then, you know, a dinner party for her is not happened unless everybody gets up and dances afterwards. Which
really? Which so she's great at casting. She knows how to cast it and stage it.
Yes,
she's a theatre.
And it's really important, that, I think. I sometimes think, actually, the food is maybe less important. It's got to be good, but it's really the sort of mix of people. And it's a bit like a restaurant as well, really, that good restaurants are about the mix of people there as well as the food.
Yeah, well, that's quite a table. I'm very envious. Can I do the washing up?
Yeah.
And just listen in.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear that conversation.
Well, I'd like to ask you too, because you'd fit in very well. So there you go.
I'd love it. I'll definitely be dancing by the end of the night. Trust me, Rick. I look forward to coming to see you on your travels and your tour next year. You've got tickets. You're touring the UK in March. Is that right?
Yes, yes. I mean, they've just announced the dates. I think we're doing 14, 15 places all over the country.
Well, thanks, Rick. Honestly, it's been a pleasure to finally get some FaceTime with you, because I've watched you for years, I've cooked you, I've eaten your dishes, and it's been fantastic to share a conversation with you. Continued success.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
Oh, what a lovely man. So nice to spend time with him. Rick Stein, his new book Simple Suppers is out now wherever you get your books, and tickets are on sale now and available for his show An Evening with Rick Stein, which tours the UK next year. For more chats with great foodies and fellow chefs, we have episodes in our back catalogue with James Martin, Faye Ripley, Tom Kerridge, Simon Rimmer, Hugh Fearnley Whittingshaw, Lisa Faulkner and John Turow, Greg Wallace, and many, many more for you to feast your ears on. In the meantime, I'll be back on Tuesday with more midweek treats from the White Wine Question Time cellar. Until then, thanks so much, as always, for your company.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.